I'm Karen Collins, and we're going to be talking about child poverty, a national crisis. And I'd like to start our session by reading together, if you can all read it from where you are, this quotation from Proverbs, and then I'll just offer a short prayer as we begin our session.
Speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. Speak out, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy.
Loving God, be with us this morning as we think about the children who are living in poverty in this country. It is through you that we do our work. Make us vehicles of your work in this world. Amen. I'd like to start by showing you a part of a videotape that was produced about 2 years ago by the National Council of Churches in consultation with NBC. It's a one-hour tape, and we're just going to look at the first two of six segments of it. So we'll just look at it for about 20 minutes. And then after we do that, I'll read a little bit about what the rest of the videotape was about, because I think it's important to have a whole context of the videotape in terms of thinking about children in poverty today. So we're going to be looking at the video screens. Some of you will have to turn your chairs around.
The children will yet say in your ears, the place is too narrow for me. Make room for me to dwell in. Isaiah chapter 49, verse 20. Where is the promise of America for our children who have become the poorest citizens of our wealthy nation? Surely, no one wishes to harm our offspring, yet we have denied many of them safe places. On the wings of some 13 million impoverished American children fly our hopes, our legacy. In the tired and worn eyes of these 13 million children mourn the tears of our country's future. Our story begins in Bastrop, Louisiana, but it could have begun in any city or state in the country, where one out of every four preschool children grows up in poverty. Here, a crisis center supported by 48 local churches tries to fill in the gap so that 1,000 families can survive day by day. There are plenty of adult clothes, but not enough clothes for the children.
During the school time, the kids are going to like to make fun of you if you ain't got clothes that look a little decent on you and stuff. And I'm just hoping that there's some new clothes up there good enough to wear to school. Really, I don't mind wearing them myself. It's just they make fun of you at school if they don't look decent. That's what starts a lot of fights.
The lack of affordable housing strikes hardest at our children. Their families are torn apart by the stresses and strains of joblessness and despair. More than half of all children living in families headed by single mothers are poor. Children are crowding our shelters. They have no room to be poor.
We have a lady who's coming here for help on her utility bill. She really needs a $75 deposit to get her gas turned on. And her husband is left, and she's pregnant.
Attending Bible class at her United Methodist Church led Nellie to volunteer and later to become director of Bastrop's Crisis Assistance Ministry.
And And I was wondering if your church had a benevolent fund to help people like them?
Shirts and shoes that don't fit, cast-offs for our forgotten young, shame heaped upon their innocent heads. Have we no room for them, no safe haven?
Seems like every month you don't have water, electricity, and we ain't had gas in 2 years. And now we gotta move. And that's the second time we done had to move since my mom divorced my dad. And, well, just getting through the year is about the most important thing, really. It's just being able to cope with the new school and being able to, new teachers and everything, and bigger building and, more people and all.
Failed education is another burden of poverty our children must bear. In Louisiana, where nearly one out of every three children is poor, over 45% of all children who enter the ninth grade drop out of high school 4 years later. And so the cycle of poverty is passed on to the next generation.
But ask Mama, do you think it would fit you then? You think so?
Okay. Poor families cannot afford medical care for their children. One in six children in America has no health insurance. Among 20 industrialized nations, the United States has the third highest infant mortality rate.
I got some toys I like, the Barbie dolls. I hope Mom and Dad will buy me for Christmas something before my birthday. I wish they would buy me a little baby that I saw with the bottle in.
The United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that all people have the right to standards of living adequate for the health and well-being of themselves and their families, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services. In America, one out of every five children and their families are being denied these fundamental rights. Cry out in shame. America's children are poorest in a land of plenty. In northeastern Louisiana, last year, Harry and Sandra lost their farm, their house, and the land upon which it stood. In 1986, the children of nearly one out of every three farmers in America lived in poverty, hunger amidst the plenty of the harvest.
Right now, we're in a pretty rough situation. We're just barely making it. And sometimes I wonder if we are going to make it through the fall. One thing we got to look forward is the good Lord let us make a good crop where we can get through next year, another year, trying to make ends meet. It's really, really rough on us and the whole family.
I enjoy farming on the family every time, but I feel like it's the worst job man can have, not for the work part, but the worries and all the aggravation that goes with it. It just pulls a man down till he don't know what to do. I won't stop. I may be putting this one out, but I will not stop.
Harry's family is receiving food stamps and emergency assistance from a farm crisis coalition of the Louisiana Interchurch Conference. During the last 2 weeks of November 1988, over 4,400 other farmers in Louisiana received notices that they were deficient on their FMHA loans. Like Harry, many will go out of business and the children will suffer.
I do a little bit. I want to be in a promo a little bit.
I don't know if I want to be a farmer when I grow up. Sometimes when you cut the beans and milo and wheat, it gives people something to eat. It goes and they put it in cans and they sell them in grocery stores. And if it wasn't anybody farming, we wouldn't have any food.
You want to put this in your pickup?
There is not much joy in the harvest for Harry and Sandra's family this year. Their combine's chain has broken, and the sweat they invest in fixing it will bring in this season's crop. Next year, someone else will be renting the land where they have toiled.
In March, I was told I needed operation. I can't get it. I need real bad. There's no way I can get it right now. And I have to, every month that comes around, I have to suffer. And I have to take medicine. I do have blood pressure problems, and I have to take medicine sometimes. I get out of my medicine for 2 weeks at a time. I know I need my medicine, but I just can't get it sometimes. Harry supplied us with about 4 months of deer meat this past fall. Let's see, in January, February, March, and April. We had deer in the freezer. That helped us a lot on the grocery bill. And we get stamps every month, but sometimes those stamps run out about a week before time, and I wish we could get more, but we can't. We have to do without milk, lots of food, until we get them the next month. But we appreciate them anyway, what we have got, because it puts food on our tables right now.
And as far as myself, I didn't even get a high school education myself. And I really feel like I need one. And I know my kids need to go to college and things even worse than I would. But it is no way that I can do it. So what future have they got ahead of them when I know I can't even help for myself? I've got some older kids here. They would love to work, and they can't even find a job, you know, now. And they would work if they could get a good job. It's rough on kids nowadays, and it makes it hard on parents because they know what they need and can't even help the kids. It's sad in countries like that. And I do believe it's a lot of people that's not realized what's taking place here. I do know it is other places that worse off than we are. And there's some other countries that is having it bad too. But I do believe the people here need to look here in the United States better and harder than what they are doing.
Nearly 1 million people left rural America last year. No matter how hard they worked, they could not fight being poor. There is little support for their children. In Louisiana, the combined aid to families with dependent children and food stamp benefits for a family of three bring them just over halfway up to the federal poverty level. The money spent on AFDC, or what is known as welfare, amounts to less than 1% of the total federal budget. cry out in shame. America's children are poorest in a land of plenty.
You see any stars, Howard? Nope.
As I explained before, these are the first two of six vignettes representing the situations that poor families in this country face. I'm just going to read you a paragraph about each of the others so you get a full sense of the range of what this video covers. Mike's children were supposed to have it made. Their father was young, white, and had a job. But they became another casualty of the layoff epidemic that continues to strike at the hopes of many an American family. Unable to find a job that could sustain the cost of child care, medical care, rent, and utilities, Mike turned to welfare. The facts are, between 1973 and 1986, the median income in families with children headed by parents under 30 fell by 26%. More than one out of every three children in young families was in poverty in 1986. That's those families under the age of 30. The fourth vignette. Linda works in a daycare center where she is paid $3.80 an hour, a wage that puts her below the federal poverty level, in order to love other people's children. It is not enough to pay for the care of her own child, however. The lack of affordable daycare has forced her into the welfare system. The facts are that the inability to afford daycare has catapulted millions of American children into poverty. In 1988, only 4,500 of the nation's 6 million businesses helped to meet their employees' child care needs. Vignette number 5. Dahlia, a child of a teenage mother and minority in one of America's poorest cities, could not escape the cycle of poverty. At 17, she brought another child of poverty into the world. Through the help of a program run by a church, Dahlia is now working and going to school. The fact is that babies born to teen mothers run a high risk of developing serious health problems because their mothers are likely to be poor and uninsured. The sixth vignette. Joey's children see hope in their mother's life. Joey set out to break the stereotypes that cripple welfare recipients. With the help of a Lutheran church in Hartford, Connecticut, she found a job and self-esteem. Working and on her own, she is ever mindful of the obstacles facing her children. The fact is, 45% of all black children in this country live in poverty. I neglected at the very beginning to tell you a little bit about who I am, and I hesitate to do that in the middle of this process, but let me just, so you have a sense of where I'm coming from, and it may be a little bit of helpful background. I have a background in early childhood education, and I taught nursery school for 8 years. After that, I went and worked at a peace and justice organization called Clergy and Laity Concerned, that some of you may know. And edited their magazine there. And I felt that I wanted, after doing that, to apply some of the larger political analysis that I had learned while working at Clergy and Laity Concerned to children. And so in 1985, I went back to graduate school to study family policy. And since that time, have been working, going to school, and working at the National Council of Churches, where I directed their child advocacy office and am currently working on health issues, a large part of that being on child health issues. So that's just a piece of analysis. I think that in order to get started, we need to understand what poverty is. Now, probably many of us know that, but can some people share, does anyone know what the official poverty level is? What does that mean in terms of a dollar amount? Does anyone know that?
$12,000. For a family of four.
Right. It's actually broken down in three different ways. There'd be a family of two, a family of three, and a family of four. And in 1990, the official poverty level for a family of two was $8,420. For a family of three, it was $10,560. And for a family of four, it was $12,700. Which means that the original idea of the poverty level was that anyone earning above the poverty level would be able to meet the basic needs of their families in terms of housing, food, health care, and the other daily necessities of living. And what has happened recently in the last couple of decades, is that the poverty level has not kept up with what the needs of families are and what it really costs to support a family. Now I'm going to have to try and reach back. In 1979, I'll have to go back and I'll get that figure, but it no longer really covers all the things that it should. A big piece of that is housing. The official poverty level says that no one should spend more than 30% of their income on housing. Well, many poor people spend a great deal more than 30% of their income on housing. That health care should be covered. Many people either don't have health care or can't pay the cost of health care. And child care, it's not uncommon for a low-income family to spend as much as half of their income for child care expenses, all of which can throw a family into poverty if they haven't already been there.
So you're saying the calculation doesn't take into account real costs that people experience.
Right. It's no longer really an accurate way of measuring what it costs to support a family of two, three, or four people. It's still used, but that's why you'll hear other organizations using different figures for what is a poverty level. And it's because other people are taking some of these other factors into account. The official poverty level is the one that the federal government uses, and those are the figures that I gave you.
Does the federal government probably take into account local variations in housing or food? Or
no.
That's ridiculous.
The states do. Like Washington State will have the basic needs like $850.
Mm-hmm.
The federal system and then everything they get, people in poverty, like some of the folks with us, reach maybe 75% of that tops for this state. And this is a good state. Washington is pretty humane. So the states have a different figure than, they have a more realistic figure than the federal government does. Yeah.
And some states are also more generous vis-a-vis children and families than other states are. I mean, Washington tends to have a fairly good policy vis-a-vis children and families, whereas they pointed out in the video that Alabama has one which is pretty awful. But there's tremendous variety there too in terms of state policy. They have state policy vis-a-vis children and families. I want to read, as we get started, I want to read who are America's poor children. 41% of the poor children in this country are white, non-Latino. 21% are Latino. 3% are Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, or Alaska Native, and the remaining 35% are African American. 38% of the children living in poverty in this country live in married couple families. So over one-third of the children in this country in poverty have both a mother and a father living with them. 54% of the children live in female-headed households. 28% of the children live in families headed by persons younger than 30. And 11% of the poor children in this country live in families headed by persons younger than 25. 28% of the poor people in this country, poor children in this country, live in suburbs. 27% live in rural areas. And 45% of poor children in this country live in central cities. I'd like now to think a little bit about what are the effects of child poverty. You know, what does it mean in a child's life to be poor? And I'd like you all to share some of what your ideas about, your perceptions, your understanding, your experience of what are the effects of child poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Shane? Close eyes. Okay. We'll put that down to milk.
Malnutrition?
Use my back here.
Bad health care.
Educational deprivation.
I would have thought drugs, but I recently heard that that crosses all economic lines. So is that legitimate?
You're right. It does cross all lines. I think that certain kinds of drugs we find in more communities than others. For example, crack is a cheaper drug, and you'll find it more often in low-income communities, and it's a particularly devastating drug. So, it's a very complicated situation, the whole drug crisis.
Yeah.
All right, but drugs is a problem, okay. Certainly, there's an awful lot of people making a lot of money with the drugs coming into poor communities.
Violence? Victims of violence?
A lot of violence.
A lack of roots for moving.
Sorry?
A lack of roots because they're moving frequently.
Particularly, you mean migrant workers? Is that what you're thinking?
Or
people who are moving to find work?
Just people that are having to move from house to house.
Okay. Good.
The homelessness.
Absolutely.
Insecurity and fear.
And
fear.
There must be some anger underneath all that, too.
If the cycle continues, it's hard to get out of.
Difficult, let's see.
They produce.
It's sort of. Let me try and find one word. Hopelessness.
But it creates
this
cyclic nature of the whole thing.
Yeah, okay. Most difficult to change situation or something like that. Okay.
Self-blame would be connected to that.
Let me get back to that. And then also the hopelessness, that's very important. Parenthetically, one of my idols in this country says that the greatest form of contraception in this country is hope. Particularly talking about teen mothers, teen parents. Well, when you put all of this together, a lack of self-confidence, a sense of insecurity, shame, low self-esteem, self-blame, leads to a hopelessness, anger, fear, a sense that it's going to be very and a reality that it's difficult to change the situation, malnourishment, bad health care, lack of adequate shelter, homelessness itself, and a lack of educational opportunities at all different levels, plus the ongoing violence caused by drugs and other things in the community, and a lack of roots to help one get through that kind of situation. It's a constellation of issues which is devastating in the life of a young child. And I think which is a situation which cannot be ignored. It's a situation which not only is robbing us now of a future workforce, which is capable of doing the kind of work that is necessary to make us a productive country. It is also robbing us of the potential of future leaders and participants in a democratic society. Not to mention the own personal pain of those children and their families and their children in an ongoing way. Let me read you a few other things about children that is very, it's linked with what the things that you just said. This is what happens in moments in America. What's happening every day? Every 35 seconds in this country, an infant is born into poverty. Every 2 minutes, an infant is born to a mother who received late or no prenatal care. Every 2 minutes, an infant is born at low birth weight, which is less than 5 pounds, 8 ounces, and therefore more susceptible to health problems ongoing. Every 11 minutes, an infant is born at very low birth weight, which is less than 3 pounds, 8 ounces, much of it preventable with prenatal care. Every 14 minutes, an infant dies in their first year of life. Every 31 seconds, an infant is born to an unmarried mother. Every 55 seconds, an infant is born to a mother who is not a high school graduate. 81% of the people in this country graduate high school, which means that almost 1 in 5 do not. And given that how important education is for getting jobs, that's fairly devastating for their families. Every 21 seconds, a 15 to 19-year-old woman becomes sexually active for the first time. And every 32 seconds, a 15 to 19-year-old woman becomes pregnant. Every 64 seconds, an infant is born to a teenage mother. Every 5 minutes, an infant is born to a teenage mother who already had a child. Every 74 seconds, a 15 to 19-year-old woman has an abortion. Every 14 hours, a child younger than 5 is murdered. Every 5 hours, a 15 to 19-year-old is murdered. Every 2 hours, a 20 to 24-year-old is murdered. Every 2 seconds of the day, a public school student is suspended. Every 4 seconds of the school day, a public school student is corporally punished. And every 10 seconds of the school day, a student drops out of school. And I'm reading from The State of America's Children, 1991, which is an annual, it's a publication from the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, D.C. And they put out a book similar to this every year that has information about all aspects of child poverty and also some information state by state by state. So that I could tell you, for example, I don't know where you're from, but what your state's level for aid to families with dependent children is, or how many children in your state are in poverty, what percentage of the state children in your particular state are in poverty. All that information is in here, so it's an invaluable tool for working on child advocacy. Why don't we, having thought a little bit about the effects of child poverty, let's try and think a little bit about why children are poor. I mean, why does this happen to start?
Children are poor.
Why are their families poor? Thank you. You're absolutely right. Yes, it's a very important distinction. Nobody wants to be poor. I mean, how does it happen? Why are so many people poor?
Maybe loss of a job.
Okay. Many of these are female head households and women don't make much money.
The change of the economic structure of the United States, the lack of the earning capacity of high school graduates are left through the changing of the steel industry, the automobile industry.
Okay.
It's becoming a service-oriented country as opposed to manufacturing.
So changes in the economy, particularly as it relates to employment. If you don't mind me piggybacking on that. Between 1973 and 1989, and I'm talking now about the median wages of hourly workers, not salaried workers, but hourly workers, adjusted for inflation, between 1973 and 1989, the average median wages of hourly workers went down 17% for women under 25, went down 19% for men over or 25, and went down a staggering 29% for men over the age of 25, which speaks to what you were saying. What else? Why else are people poor?
Decreases in either government or private benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Things like hospitals bailing out of emergency care.
Okay. So decreases in financial benefits first, right? Is that the first one you mentioned?
Well, financial or something like health care, kind of an in-kind benefit.
Okay. Also health care. Or other services, what could we say? Or other benefits?
Health care and related services.
Inflation.
Yes.
And talking about cost of health care, our TARP law system increases the cost of health care horribly.
Is that like malpractice? What do you mean?
All the insurance that is paid for to protect themselves against suit.
Malpractice.
Our TARP law system.
And the lack of affordable housing, too.
Mm-hmm.
What about lack of job skills?
I'm sorry?
Lack of job skills.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or skills that are so specialized.
Mm-hmm. Lack of specialized job skills?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
And then just maybe it's just like literacy, too. You can't just fill out an application regardless of the kinds of skills you may actually possess. You'll never get a chance to prove yourself.
Poverty breeds poverty.
Unplanned pregnancies.
No.
Poverty breeds poverty is my perception is the one that's most troubling because of what you were saying, I think. They even have a word for it, a couple words for it now. I don't like the word, I don't use it, but underclass is, not underclass, yeah, the underclass and the culture of poverty. That in fact some people simply given up on it and say, you're not going to do anything with any of these people.
Well, like ghetto living there. Yeah. Or barrio or whatever term you use.
That's not including a lot of the things we saw up there, like the farmers and all, but the very specifically, we've classed the people, a group of people now.
Well,
it's the first time in decades that that's ever been done. Specifically, children.
Yeah. It was interesting, along that line, I was reading a book recently by a woman who was writing specifically about health care, and she said that there are very real differences in the behavior patterns of poor people and not poor people in terms of seeking health care and maintaining their health. But if finances were equivalent, if finances were not an issue, the patterns would be exactly the same. And that they've demonstrated this. Which I think is very important to name the different patterns, because that is a reality and that is part of what we face in assuring, for example, health care for all children who need it. But we have to be careful not to blame the victims and to recognize that finances are a root cause of what those patterns might be. No one wants to be poor, and no one wants to not give adequate health, not get good health care for their children. There's other things that are going on when that happens.
We've had kind of inflation of expectations too, in terms of what the minimum level is for our society. Like, I can think of 40 years ago, an eighth grade education was considered adequate to, you know, mm-hmm. get out and get a job. Mm-hmm. And now they tell people not to bother with anything less than high school.
Mm-hmm. And actually, and in many situations where college is required, or yeah. some level of college, and the figure is that only 58% of the people in this country ever enroll in a college of any sort, which means, and substantially fewer than that ever graduate. So we're talking about half the people in our workforce don't have some of the basic requirements that many employers are asking for. What about the minimum wage?
It's not enough to live on,
definitely. In April 1st of this year, the minimum wage went to $4.25 an hour. If you multiply that out, $4.25 an hour, 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, no vacations, no sick time because we're not salaried, it comes out to approximately 80% of the poverty level. So even if you are working full-time, at the minimum wage, you will not be able to bring your income will be less than the poverty level.
That also overlooks that most of those jobs are not full-time, so right. they can get away from having to pay other benefits.
Right. Right. Very important. That's right. There are the other benefits.
So
it's
even
right.
more of a poverty.
Right. Very important.
Individual states also, but you know, everyone thinks they're covered under the federal. You're not. The state of Washington until last year. The minimum wage was $2.35 an hour. And the one woman who spoke to the state of Washington, is up here, who worked under that, was the only one willing to testify down in Olympia. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll have her talk if she's willing. But anyway, she became a sort of a celebrity for a day. And the news, you know, they recorded a story. Next day she lost her $2.40. But they raised it finally. Because there are some businesses that don't fall under, because they're small, they're not covered under federal. A lot of people don't realize that. And that there's 40,000 people in this state that were working for $2.50 an hour.
Okay.
And we're not talking about McDonald's. At least 40,000. No medical, nothing. They aren't even touch benefits. There's nothing at all.
Yeah, the issue that's really being what we're getting to here is it's really becoming a two-class society, and when decisions are made with the minimum wage, is these are the guys that own the restaurants, that, you know, the business people and the political figures are so interwoven that it's possible to make decisions that affect the other people. And I think that in a lot of ways with the educational expectations, it's the same thing. You have it or you don't. Divides into two groups.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about what the government's responsibility is in this and what's already going on. I mean, what are people's perceptions of the federal role in this, in dealing with child poverty, and dealing with poverty of families?
What they have done or what they should do?
Well, let's start with what's currently going on.
Well, I think the change in tax structure has contributed a lot. Impoverishing people.
Mm-hmm.
There have been tremendous increases at the lower levels, which are not called income tax, but it's come out in Social Security and those sorts of taxes, which have fallen quite unfairly on the poor people.
Tax policy. We've allowed our legislatures to decrease the benefits for the poor.
Now, which benefits are you talking about?
I'm not sure. But I believe that from what I've read in the papers that mm-hmm. the laws have been changing to decrease the amount of money for the, even in our state of Pennsylvania, school benefits for the the children in an IU or a special education classroom and lunch programs for children who can't afford to buy cut. And somehow it's just gone past those of us that are constituents to our legislators to allow this to happen. So that those what would you call that? Not really a response, sort of a protest or
awareness?
That's also true. What, I'm going to put protest. Too strong. To allow these changes to happen.
In fact, more than just inadequate awareness, it sounds like the minimum wage standard that you talked about not being realistic is almost attempting to hide the problem.
And I think that a lot of the change that happened in federal policy, for example, in 1979, federal policies and programs directed towards poor families actually raised 1 in 5 families out of poverty. Now that's not terribly effective. We need to do much better than that. But in 1979, federal programs were raising 1 in 5 families out of poverty. A decade later, federal programs were raising 1 in 10 families out of poverty. So during the Reagan administration, basically, that about half of the families that might potentially have been raised out of poverty earlier are no longer through federal programs. Yeah?
It seems that we need to adjust the system so that those people who are able to and willing to work would not be penalized for working, because so often it's much easier to stay on welfare because then they have all the health benefits. Once they go to work for this minimum wage of $2.50 or whatever, they have no benefits.
Okay, so it's not in their best interest to go off welfare.
Right. In many cases, that's true. All right.
Okay, I'm sure we could go on and on with this, so let's stop for now. And let's think a little bit about our faith and what our theology says to us about this kind of situation. I mean, what are, as people of faith, largely from the ELCA, but from a lot of other communions and backgrounds as well, what are we told to do? I mean, how as Christians do we respond to this kind of a situation?
Priorities in congregation. So I think that a support system for the poor is lacking within our churches or all. Earlier this week, there was the two lesbian women who talked about the strength they got from the support system. What kind of support system do the poor in our communities get from the mainline churches? I don't see much.
Okay, so far I've said, what does our faith tell us vis-a-vis child poverty? Okay, and I'll change from here on in. And you said inadequate support for families.
Well,
is that fair?
But, you know, kind of a challenge in the churches working on.
So you want to phrase it differently, that churches need to support families more? What else?
Well, I think that churches need to move from a charity mentality to a justice mentality, because we've been about, you know, oh, at Christmas we'll make a basket and give it to the poor people. Well, that's good and they need that, but that's just going to feed them for Christmas. And we need to be about doing justice, not giving away charity. I mean, we have to do both for a while,
But justice needs to be the emphasis. Changing the policies, making it so that people don't have to live this way, so that there is affordable housing, working for health care that everybody has access to.
We need to increase our own awareness by learning some things here that I wasn't aware of.
We need to change our definition of a successful society from how many people can afford BMWs to how are the poorest.
You want to redefine being American means?
Safeway store had captured it for me 2 years ago. I have this original ad. It ran for 2 years straight and won a national award. It was, and it had a jingle and everything. It was, you're working on his day, you're getting on his deal at Safeway. And the original ads were very exclusive. They changed it because there was been a lot of criticism that came out, and it only showed working people. They left out the seniors, no children. But it captured what we call the Protestant work ethic so well, because you're working on his day, you get an honest deal, which means those who don't work, quote, an honest day, don't deserve what little they're going to get anyway. So it was a real interesting thing. It's fun to talk about that, because to change that idea, really, you'd have to literally change your whole understanding of our ideology, this country.
Do you want to go beyond that to change our ideology?
Right? Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, I think that places the churches in a real bind, because if you were going to be theologically honest, you have to be head over heels in that direction. And it means real personal change for most of us here. It means a whole lifestyle change. I work in foster care, and the statistic that burns me the most, you pay more to kennel your dog in Washington State than you do in a month for a child in foster care.
Feed your dog.
Reclassifying the foster children as pets.
If you worked in the welfare system.
I was going to say.
Sounds like somebody has been working the system, right?
But you know, what does that mean to us who have dogs? You know, I mean, I would say that's a good way to, you know, to give an example and say, look, we're underfunding children's services. But what does that mean to me? I've got a dog. You know, what's the personal level of that?
I have a dog too, and she just had a very expensive operation.
Yeah.
Terribly expensive.
Well, in our society, it would be critical of us if I didn't take good care of my dog and if you didn't get an operation for your dog.
So we need
children who are living on less than that.
You
know,
when families in Alabama get $337 a month, we're on AFDC, and that has to cover everything. So you're right. I mean, and certainly an operation costs a lot of money.
Okay, then.
I'm sorry, Wayne.
Well, I just was, it's a thing that I wrestle with a lot, the enabler concept versus responsible health.
Okay, you want to say another sentence about that?
Well, and this is just from some personal experience of my living in Oregon, and I have a niece who's on welfare, a teen mom who has, I think we're enabling her.
Mm-hmm.
We're enabling her. And I've seen this also when I did some foster care.
What's the alternative to enabling?
Well, you've got to be responsible for some of this. You did make some choices. And it is true that the welfare system, she sees that as being a better outlet than anything else right now. But I've also seen, not with her so much, but with some others, really not having good skills at budgeting and knowing what their resources are and looking at how am I going to make it work. Being able to be, having enough education, enough ability to think through the whole month having enough ability. And again, you come into this definition of a successful society, that they are bombarded by the media and sometimes purchase things that they probably clearly really cannot afford. Also, and this is where my niece got in very serious trouble, was the ability to buy anything on credit with amazing ease. And now, you know, we're all in Oregon paying for some of that, the nonsense, the total nonsense, with the ease that you can go into any shopping mall and large department stores and whittle up $500 bill.
It's such a tricky issue, isn't it, really?
It is real tricky, because it leaves you like, wait a minute, how in the world did you ever find the pay for this? Well, I just signed on the line.
But it's also a situation where you have to be very careful not to blame the person who is already being victimized by the problem. And to understand, I think, the concept that I alluded to earlier, that our patterns of the way we live are largely determined by the amount of income we have, and that those patterns will change if our incomes would be more the same, if our incomes were more consistent with each other. There are also racial, ethnic, and cultural differences, of course, but our level of income is basic to that. I think we have to be real careful not to blame the victim.
The thing is, those two things are always in tension. In this state, in the last 3 years, it's just happened. Our folks, at least that I work with, are poor, do not go to Nordstrom's, Freddie and Ellie's, or any of those stores. What has happened all over the county is Rent-A-Centers have just come up. And Rent-A-Centers do not work on a monthly budget. They work on a weekly budget. And poor people work on weekly things. And when they send out their advertisements now, you can have all that furniture and those VCRs and everything else, and you pay by the week. And almost all of them don't mind doing it because they feel, well, I got $16 this week. They don't add up. It's $50 a month plus. And then these places, by the way, are very sophisticated. They are not grungy, sleazy outfits. They are young, well-dressed people. And so the structure allows them to have everything that everybody else who's middle class can have. And you try to say no to that after a
while. Our advertising, you know, people seem to be taught that they need all these things to live a good life.
Or that they deserve it.
We have no education.
Sure.
And then you're stuck. You really feel that you deserve all that. And that, if, like he said, if it's $16 a week, you'll do it. You'll do it and then wonder at the end of the month, why don't I have the money to do the things?
And so a lot of what we have to address are the kind of economic policies of
that
business.
I think that kind of business, I hope I'm not offending them, it should be shut down.
So the bottom line is all this, what are we going to do about it?
Well,
I mean, we talk about mountaintop experiences, and certainly Holden Village is a kind of mountaintop experience. But what do we do when we go back down into the valleys? What is it that we're going to do?
We'll take those videos and a couple of copies of those books.
Okay, let me tell you, I'll just tell you a little bit about that. If anyone is interested in the video, I can tell you where to get it. In fact, why don't I just read this to you. Do people have pencils? Not a lot of people. Well, just quickly, you can get it from Ecufilm, ECU Film, at 800. The phone number is 800-251-4091. The State of America's Children is from the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, D.C. And I'm going to be using this book all week, so I'm not going to put it in the library for people to look at. But please just find me. And I would love to have you look at the book and get the address.
Where do we get it? You're going to give it to us later?
Well, here, let me give it to you. Their address is 122 C Street, Northwest.
And they'll send you the book if you donate money to the Children's Defense Fund.
In Washington, D.C.
Oh, thank you.
2001. Their number is 202-628-8787. And along that line, I really would like to push this book, I ordered this for the bookstore, but I neglected to give an address. And the woman who runs the bookstore didn't know the Children's Defense Fund, so she didn't know how to find it. Welcome the Child is a brand new book just out early this year. It's for congregations. What do you do in your own local situation if you really want to address problems that children in this country face? It's not restricted to child poverty. It includes child poverty and then the manifestations of poverty, the child health problems, child care problems, teen pregnancy prevention problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very practical, has liturgy ideas, hymn ideas, biblical references, how to get started, surveys for your congregation and your community, et cetera, et cetera. It's a wonderful, wonderful hands-on resource. I had an intern in my office this year, and it came into the office and he started looking through it. I said, okay, Orlando, give it back. He said, no way. I almost didn't get it back from him because as a pastor, he said, this is what I need. So in closing, I would just like to read a poem, which was adapted from a poem by the Nobel Prize winning poet Gabriela Mistral from Chile. It's called The Child's Name is Today. We are guilty of many errors and faults, but our worst crime is abandoning the children, neglecting the fountain of life. Many of the things we need can wait. The child cannot. Right now is the time bones are being formed, blood is being made, senses are being developed. To the child we cannot answer tomorrow. The child's name is today. Thank you very much.